is United States v. Seymour. Mr. Cornea.
Good morning. Reed Cornea for Robert Seymour. May it please the court. Counsel. Robert Seymour is seeking this appeal because he's seeking completeness. Rule 608B is about completeness. It allows specific instances of untruth to be brought to light. Rule allows counsel to ask questions concerning specific instances during cross-examination. It's a rule that is there to allow juries to make a discriminating appraisal of a witness's testimony. It's there to assist the jury in determining credibility, bias, or motives. The jury in Mr. Seymour's case was not afforded this opportunity. They were not afforded the opportunity to make a full appraisal of the government's main and only witness of consequence, Officer Essling. Just a couple of weeks before Mr. Seymour and Officer Essling met up, Officer Essling, after being given a particular gesture by a jaywalker, assaulted the jaywalker, gave the jaywalker a concussion, and gave him a citation for jaywalking.
You know, it's hard to see, even if you're right, that this could be anything but harmless error, given the defense, which seemed to be pretty hard to believe.
Well, I think there's a lot of there's evidence in here that suggests that it's not harmless error. Again, Officer Essling is the government's one and only witness of consequence. Officer Essling testified that he did not see Mr. Seymour with a gun. He testified in the two tussles that they had, one immediately after the car pulled over, did not feel a gun, and as they tussled again, approximately 20 to 30 meters from the vehicle, he did not feel a gun. And in fact,
yeah, but you did offer a defense in this case. You had somebody testify.
Yes,
that,
and
that they saw somebody else. Just
we did
come up and put the gun under the sweatshirt.
Well, that's not what she said necessarily. The defense was, and what happened was, after the second tussle, the sweatshirt was left in the hands of Officer Essling. He threw it to the ground. He testified he did not feel any extra heft. And this was a 22 caliber pistol, but it was a large 22 caliber pistol. And proceeded to chase after Mr. Seymour. Mr. Seymour surrendered on the backside of the apartment complex and was pepper sprayed, taken into custody. This all occurred in front of Ms. Johnson's apartment. And her testimony was that she saw the initial fight in front of her apartment. This was about 20 or 30 yards from the vehicle. Watched them take off again, and was looking out the window and saw somebody come from the direction of the vehicle, the parked vehicle, lift up the sweatshirt, and run off. Now, when Officer Essling stopped the vehicle, the front passenger immediately took off running. Mr. Seymour stepped out of the vehicle, and that's where the initial tussle occurred. Three other individuals in the back seat of the car remained. When they came back around after arresting Mr. Seymour from the backside of the apartment complex, the vehicle was gone. And I think another key issue here is that suggests that there's not overwhelming evidence in this case is the fact that Officer Essling, in his testimony and in his police report, provide different descriptions of what happened. Now, they're similar in many ways, but the police report, as was noted at trial, stated that Officer Essling wrote that as the sweatshirt was being picked up, as it was being picked up, Mr. Seymour said, "That gun's not mine." Now, at trial, apparently Officer Essling's memory improved, and he noted that he remembered it specifically being before the sweatshirt was picked up. So we have a witness whose memory is improving with time and who essentially says what he wrote in his police report shortly after what occurred is not what really happened. And the reason why we needed to introduce the 608B evidence is because there is the issue of credibility here. And I think those statements made by Officer Essling in his police report and at trial suggest that the jury, in order to get a full and complete appraisal of his credibility, should have been allowed to hear the fact that on September 24th, when he filled out a police report, he did not include in that police report his use of force. He didn't include in that police report that he used excessive force.
He didn't lie about it.
Well,
he just didn't put it in.
I would say he did lie about it. I teach my daughter that when there's lies of omission and there's lies of commission. And when you do something and you leave something out or not tell somebody as a means of protecting your self-interest.
Doesn't something like this have to be left to the judge? Because I think there's something to your argument, but if the judge allows examination about this, it's going to get into his use of excessive force, which is irrelevant, but very damaging, right?
It can be, and I think that's up to the judge to determine how far to let.
Well, I don't understand how he could, how this issue of what you're describing as a misleading omission can be explored in front of the jury without mentioning that what he omitted was his slamming this person against the wall. And doesn't that distract the jury from the issues in this case, which is not the conduct of the policeman in another case?
Well, I think part of the conduct of the policeman is at issue here, because key to this case is when
you're not going to have trials in which you go into the disciplinary history of the police, right?
No, and I think the district judge can craft instructions to deal with that.
Instructions, please. Be realistic.
It's one way of doing it.
It's not a good way.
Well, I think in all fairness to a defendant, when there has been a police officer who has misled his police department for self-interest, who has essentially lied to the police.
There isn't anybody in this country who hasn't lied at one time or another, right?
I would say that's probably true.
Right.
But I would also suggest that when you lie in your
best into every witness's history of lying.
No, but that's up to the judge, and 608B provides the judge with the discretion to limit it. You look at some of the case law out there that deals with this. There's cases where individuals have they take the I believe it's the Jackson case where there was an issue over one of the witnesses was a landlord who argued. Or who apparently didn't fill out his bankruptcy petition fully, didn't name all of his court cases. Defense sought to introduce that evidence at trial. The district judge denied that. And part of the reason he denied that was because the defense counsel and the defendant had a full opportunity to address and attack the credibility of the police officer or of the landlord through other means. I mean, there was a myriad of means to address the credibility of the landlord. So
you had a conflicting police report and testimony, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, the police
and
report.
I'm sure that there's a lot of cross examination on that, right?
And we did.
And then
yeah.
You have an independent witness, or supposedly
correct.
Independent, who sees. What at least someone else put the gun there, and so there's you have that same issue to argue too with the witness Esterling. What good would it do to get into what he did some other time? Wouldn't it take away from that focus, which is your best defense? If you get into that issue,
well, I think it lets the jury know that this officer is willing to pad his police reports for his self-interest. Look, we all want to win. Officer Esterling wants to win. The U.S. Attorney wants to win. I want to win. The question is, do we win it within the ethical bounds that are in front of us? This officer has a proven track record where he's willing to step outside of those bounds to protect his own self-interest. And I think that is important.
Not necessarily protecting self-interest, protecting the police department also.
Well, maybe so, but again, protecting the police department or protecting his self-interest, maybe be one and the same. In the end, he gets 8 days of unpaid leave for his actions. And I think when Judge Shabazz went through his description of this, he focused primarily on the issue of violence and how violence doesn't relate.
Yeah, but no, he talked about the deceit issue.
Well, he said at the very end that, well, and he forgot to fill out a dance card.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cornea. Ms. Duschenman?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Meredith Duschman, and I represent Appellee of the United States. Forgive my voice. I'm a little bit under the weather here. I want to kind of jump right into the district court's finding that this was not probative of the officer's character for truthfulness or untruthfulness. Obviously, the United States does not believe that this finding was an abuse of discretion. The defendant contends that the officer's failure to properly document his use of force on the jaywalking citation was a lie by omission. I certainly concede there are lies by omission, no doubt about it, but every omission is not a lie. There has to be some intent to deceive. And I think the problem in this case is that the defendant just asked the court to infer it. And the court said, no, I'm not going to infer it. I'm not going to create evidence to support your interpretation of the facts. The court said there was no evidence in the record.
You're leading with your weakest argument, right? Yeah,
well,
because clearly he didn't want to put this in the report because it's embarrassing. It could get him into trouble, as it did.
Well, I think that's certainly an inference you can draw.
That's the only inference you can draw. What's the other inference?
Well, I think that a proper inference is, frankly, that he was lazy. It was 10:45 at night on a Saturday.
The fact he omitted if he's lazy.
Well, because he didn't want to have to do a whole separate supplemental report on a jaywalking citation. Again, I don't differ with the court's statement.
I find that very unpersuasive.
Well, I don't differ with the court that is an interpretation, but I think it's not the only interpretation. And it just simply wasn't in the record, and I don't think the court abused its discretion in finding that it wasn't within the province of 608B evidence in the first place. Moving on to what I take from the court's statement is our stronger argument, which is a harmless error argument. The context of this case, I think, is significant. Here you've got the officer who tries to pull over a car the defendant is driving because it's reported stolen. The defendant, who's the driver, flees, as does the passenger. Given the fact that the defendant is the driver of the stolen vehicle, the officer pursues the defendant. A struggle ensues. There's a tussle. They both fall to the ground. The defendant tries to get up and flee. The officer grabs onto that sweatshirt, and it falls to the ground as the defendant is able to flee again.
How close are they to the car? Is that known?
Pardon me?
How close were they to the car when you pulled
the sweatshirt? I can't recall in terms of feet, but in terms of chronology, the first fight is significantly closer to the vehicle than the second fight. So in other words, when the defendant flees for the second time, it's significantly farther away from not only the vehicle's original location, but from where that sweatshirt is on the ground. And nobody disputes that the officer and the defendant were no longer in the line of sight of the sweatshirt when the second tussle ensued. The officer finally gets control of the defendant, gets him handcuffed, comes back through the area, and that's where the gun is located. And nobody disputes that. Your Honor, actually,
the other
raised
people
this.
Ran from the car, right?
Pardon me?
The other passengers ran from the car.
The person in the passenger seat ran also.
Is that the only other person in the car?
No, there were other occupants in the car.
I see. So other people could have driven it off then.
Yes. Your Honor alluded to this, and I think this is so significant. The defendant called a witness who supposedly lived at this apartment complex. She claimed that while the officer and the defendant were out of view of the sweatshirt that was laying on the ground during the second struggle, she saw another individual place something, which could have been a gun, under the sweatshirt. defense counsel argued in closing that the jury should infer somebody else planted the gun. In this way, this trial was really more about the credibility of the defense witness than it even was about the government witness. Because if the jury believed the defense witness, they would have acquitted the defendant, period. This is not, I mean, this is a he didn't do it defense. And the jury obviously didn't believe her because they convicted him. I think what's also significant about this case is there's no allegation the officer used excessive force on the defendant. In fact, there's no obligation the officer left anything out of his police reports at all. There's no allegation the gun was planted by the police or that the officer should have known that somebody else might have put this gun here. And in fact, there's no dispute that the defendant said, "That's not my gun." There's a dispute about when he said it, but as the court already alluded to, that was fleshed out during cross-examination. The jury had an opportunity to hear that. Also, I just want to briefly mention, as stated in the government's brief, the fact that he was actually suspended for the conduct. I don't think under 608B in the committee notes, and I've obviously reviewed Dawson and I'm familiar with that, and even under that case, I don't think that the fact he was suspended would have come in. And so if you consider what part of what the defendant wanted to come in would have come in light of the circumstances of the case, in light of the defense they were presenting, do not believe it affected the jury's verdict. For all of these reasons, we would ask that the court affirm the defendant's conviction.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Duschenman. So, Mr. Corney, your time expired, but if you have something further, you can have a minute.
I'll make a minute. Thank you, Your Honor. Just quickly, Judge Shabazz made this decision based on an interpretation of Mansky and that this case, or the Officer Essling, used violence, and violence was not indicative of untruthfulness. That also led to his decision that under 403, that the evidence would also be prejudiced. It was an error on his part. The argument was that Officer Essling falsified a police report for his own self-interest, and that is what we sought to introduce. Robert Seymour deserves the opportunity to provide a full and complete picture to the jury, and the jury deserves the opportunity to have a full and complete picture of a defendant's credibility, motive, and bias. And they were not afforded this in this case. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Corney. And you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client.